On the left is a complicated mathematical equation, followed by the words, "Then a miracle occurs," which leads to another exotic equation on the right. Gesturing toward the miracle reference, one scientist says to the other, "I think you should be more explicit here in step two." Can Christians be explicit about how the cosmological evidence points toward a supernatural, miracle-working creator? Or should we shrug our shoulders, as Shermer suggests, and concede we don't know where everything came from? I was anxious to get knowledgeable responses to Shermer and to build on the scientific evidence that I had compiled for my earlier book, The Case for a Creator. So I zipped an email to a popular and impressively credentialed professor of physics. The result was a sit-down interview in his house, not far from the University of Oklahoma campus in Norman. Like Shermer, Michael George Strauss is an ardent bicyclist, riding 4 miles to his office at the university and then pumping for 20 more miles on a circuitous way home. Asked if he rides for exercise or fun, he replied, "Yes." Maybe that's one reason he looks so much younger than his nearly 60 years. His brown hair, worn slightly over his ears, is resisting gray, and his unlined face and clear blue eyes give him a fresh, boyish appearance. Strauss first became interested in science as a youngster, when he lived in Huntsville, Alabama, where NASA built the first stage of the mighty Saturn V rocket that later took astronauts to the moon. There's still enthusiasm in his voice when he says, "They'd light those boosters to test them, and wow, the whole town would shake." Strauss graduated valedictorian from high school and later studied science and theology at Biola University. While pursuing a graduate degree in physics at UCLA, Strauss became fascinated by quantum mechanics and subatomic particles, joining a high-energy physics experimental group doing research at the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center. Later, he received his doctorate in high-energy physics at UCLA, pinning his dissertation on the scintillating topic, "A Study of Lambda Polarization and Phi Spin Alignment in Electron-Positron Annihilation at 29 GeV as a Probe of Color Field Behavior." I'll give you a moment to process your regret over the fact that he beat you to that topic. Strauss joined the faculty of the University of Oklahoma in 1995 and is currently the David Ross Boyd Professor of Physics, having earned several awards for teaching excellence. For 15 years, he conducted research at the Fermi National Accelerator Center. These days, he performs research at CERN's Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland, smashing protons together to understand, among other things, the properties of the top quark, the fundamental particle with the highest mass. He collaborated on one of two experiments that used data from the collider to help discover the Higgs boson, the so-called God particle, in 2012, which was the last unverified part of the standard model of particle physics. The reference to a deity does not reflect any divine characteristics of the particle itself, but was coined primarily because it was so difficult to find. Ironically, the particle's namesake, Peter Higgs, is an atheist. Now, Strauss is among those on the hunt for evidence of higher-mass Higgs bosons. Interestingly, Strauss's study of the world's tiniest particles has become more and more relevant to understanding the origin and order of our vast universe itself. This is because when the collider hurls protons together, the resulting energy density is so high that it simulates what the universe was like a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang, helping lead to new insights into the study of cosmology. That's what I came to discuss with him. Does the origin and fine-tuning of the universe point to God as a creator of quarks, leptons, Higgs bosons, and other building blocks of nature? We sat down to chat in the front room of his house. "When I go to the lab, I don't expect to see the supernatural," he told me at the outset. "If miracles happened all the time, we wouldn't be able to study the usual way nature works. But Just because something works a certain way most of the time, with natural laws, doesn't mean there can't be exceptions. In fact, he continued, I was just reading an illustration of this. Suppose aliens observed our traffic lights to understand how they work, and they figured out what red, yellow, and green mean. Suddenly, a vehicle with flashing lights and a siren comes screaming through the intersection, breaking all the rules. Does this mean the standard rules are no longer valid because there's an occasional exception? Of course not. I was about to ask a follow-up question when Strauss jumped in with an interesting theological observation. By the way, the Bible says that it's through the natural processes of nature that we most commonly see evidence for God, not just through his miracles, he pointed out. Romans 1, verse 20 tells us that God's invisible qualities are clearly seen. Through what? Through what he has made. And Psalm 19, verse 1 says, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. So, frankly, we don't need miracles to find evidence for God. It's right there, embedded in the natural processes he has created and that we, as scientists, are studying. It was a good reminder that when protons collide and explode into even tinier particles, scientists are getting a glimpse into the incredible complexity and wonder of God's creativity. Just as we detect his supernatural qualities when we watch an awesome thunderstorm sweep through the countryside or gaze at a multitude of stars winking in the night sky. Nevertheless, I added, ambulances might scream through our lives every once in a while. How about you? Have you had an experience that you can only explain as a supernatural intervention of God? Well, only is a strong word for a scientist, he began, so probably not. But there are a lot of things I believe, even though I've never personally experienced them. For example, I believe DNA has a helical structure, but I've never seen that myself. When I hear credible people talk about something that can only be explained supernaturally, I don't need to experience it myself to believe that something supernatural has occurred. Going back to the ancient Greeks, most philosophers and scientists believed that the universe is eternal, and that suited a lot of them quite well. Many scientists are philosophical naturalists, believing that there's nothing beyond the physical world, Strauss said. If the universe has always existed, then that's quite consistent with their philosophy. Most of them know that if the universe did indeed have a beginning and is continuing to expand, that would have big theological implications. When Albert Einstein came up with his general theory of relativity in 1915 and applied it to the universe as a whole, he was aghast that it showed the universe should either be growing or collapsing. His solution? Add a fudge factor to his equation to hold back gravity and thus stabilize the universe, a move he later conceded was the biggest blunder of his career. To this day, the theistic consequences of having a beginning to the universe are readily apparent even to atheists. In his bestseller, A Brief History of Time, theoretical physicist Stephen Hawking wrote, "So long as the universe had a beginning, we could suppose it had a creator." I asked Strauss, "What compelled virtually all scientists to conclude that the universe had a beginning, even though some of them had to be dragged kicking and screaming to that conclusion?" Back in the 1920s, the Russian mathematician Alexander Friedman and the Belgian philosopher Georges Lemaître used Einstein's theories to formulate a model showing that the universe was expanding, he said. So, if you play the tape of the universe backwards, it shrinks down to the Big Bang, I offered. Yes, that was the term that British philosopher Fred Hoyle came up with. He was an outspoken atheist who was being derogatory and poking fun at the idea, but the term stuck. In fact, Hoyle was so anxious to get rid of the universe's beginning that he later developed the steady-state theory, which conceded that, yes, the universe is expanding, but it is generating its own new matter as it goes, and therefore never had a beginning that would require a creator. His theory did succeed in doing away with a starting point, but it has been universally rejected by cosmologists today because of mounting evidence that the universe did have a beginning more than 13 billion years ago. I asked Strauss, what were the scientific discoveries that confirmed the Big Bang theory? There were three of them, he replied. First, in 1929, the American astronomer Edwin Hubble discovered the so-called redshift in light coming from distant galaxies, which is the result of galaxies literally flying apart from each other at enormous speeds. So this showed that our universe is rapidly expanding. Second, in 1964, Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson measured the cosmic background microwave radiation, which showed that the leftover heat from the Big Bang was minus 450 degrees Fahrenheit. This is exactly what we would expect if the Big Bang occurred. The third discovery involves the origin of light elements. Heavier elements formed later in stars and were expelled into space by supernova, but very light elements like hydrogen and helium had to be forged in a much hotter environment like the Big Bang. When we measure the amount of these two elements in the universe, we find they are precisely what the theory predicted to within one part in 10,000. The case, then, is airtight to you? I asked. Given the evidence, in my opinion, not believing in the Big Bang is like believing the Earth is flat. To me, the data is that strong. The Big Bang is the origin of everything we know, space, time, matter, and energy. Any caveats? Maybe one. We can't measure what happened in the initial split second after the Big Bang. This is when most scientists believe inflation began, momentarily expanding the universe faster than the speed of light. I held up my hand. Whoa, wait a second, I said. I didn't think anything could go faster than the speed of light. Nothing inside the universe can, but space itself can actually expand faster than light. So we've lost all information about what happened before inflation started at about a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang. We need a quantum theory of gravity to describe what occurred, and we don't have that yet. Nevertheless, I said, do you believe everything goes back to a beginning? Yes, I think that's clear. Some people like to propose exotic theories for what happened in those microseconds. But cosmologist Lawrence Krauss, who's an outspoken atheist, conceded in a recent debate that the universe probably did begin to exist, even giving quantum theories of gravity. As more and more discoveries are made, is the evidence for the Big Bang getting stronger or weaker? I asked. Stronger, for sure, he said. For instance, we've been studying the cosmic background radiation with increasing precision through the Planck satellite, and it's still pointing toward the Big Bang. Not only does all the evidence confirm that the universe is expanding, but it's actually accelerating. In addition, three prominent cosmologists in 2003 formulated what is called the Bohr-Guth-Vilenkin theorem, which says that any universe that is expanding on average throughout its history cannot be infinite in the past, but must have a beginning. If that theorem is correct, it applies to our universe, regardless of what happened in the microseconds after the Big Bang. William Lane Craig is one of many philosophers who offers various arguments for the existence of God. But if you count the number of articles published in philosophy journals in recent years, you'll find more discussion about Craig's Kalam cosmological argument than any other contemporary defense of theism. The Cambridge Companion to Atheism says, "Theists and atheists alike cannot leave Craig's Kalam argument alone." The argument derives its name from the Arabic for medieval theology, which is appropriate since it was first formulated by 11th century Muslim philosopher Abu Hamid Muhammad ibn Muhammad al-Ghazali. His reason is summarized in three steps. 1. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. 2. The universe began to exist. 3. Therefore, the universe has a cause. I asked Strauss, what's your assessment of the Kalam argument? It's extremely strong, he said. Think about it. Is there anything that comes into existence without a cause behind it? Some scientists say there may be uncaused quantum events, but I think there are good reasons to be skeptical about that. And we know from the evidence that the universe did come into existence. If those two premises of the argument are true, then the conclusion inexorably follows. The universe has a cause. I said, some skeptics, including the late astronomer Carl Sagan, suggest there might be merit to the idea of an oscillating universe, where the universe expands, then crunches back down, and then expands again, on for infinity, without a beginning. Is there evidence to back this up? Well, not really. Entropy, which is roughly the amount of disorder, would continue to increase from one cycle to the next, meaning each succeeding oscillation would get bigger and bigger. Run the tape backward, and you get smaller and smaller oscillations until you get to a beginning, Strauss responded. Besides, this would require that dark energy, which scientists suspect is accelerating the expansion of the universe, would suddenly reverse itself and cause the universe to collapse. That's stretching things beyond credulity. I said, others propose that the universe simply popped out of nothing from the quantum foam fluctuations of empty space. Make sense? Quantum foam is the space-time fabric of the universe. It is not nothing. So if the universe popped out of it, where did the quantum foam come from? You'd have to account for that. Now, quantum fluctuations do allow brief periods of time when virtual particles pop into existence, caused by quantum energy, and then go back out of existence. What's the time scale? Trillionths of a second, he said. So, to postulate that something which happens in a trillionth of a second could create an entire universe that lasts billions of years is an extrapolation that seems extremely unreasonable to me. I'll be honest, if this wasn't a way to try to get around God, nobody would have ever thought of it, in my opinion. In my interview, the skeptic Michael Shermer said the best answer to how the universe originated is simply, we don't know. He suggested there might be other possible explanations than God did it. Look, we don't live our lives based on obscure possibilities. We live our lives based on probabilities. Is it possible my wife poisoned my cereal this morning? Anything is possible, but not everything is probable, he replied. The real question is, given what we observe with the universe, what's the highest probability? Everything tells us there was a real beginning. Everything else is a mere possibility, with no observational or experimental evidence to back it up. Craig came to a similar conclusion. In a sense, the history of 20th century cosmology can be seen as a series of one failed attempt after another to avoid the absolute beginning predicted by the standard Big Bang model, he wrote. This parade of failed theories only serves to confirm the prediction of the standard model that the universe began to exist. Perhaps Alexander Vilenkin, director of the Institute of Cosmology at Tufts University, put it best. Quote, with the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning. Close quote. Creation of the universe from nothing is an epic miracle. But there's more. Just as the Big Bang wasn't a haphazard event, but a highly ordered phenomenon, the ongoing operation of the universe is an incredibly intricate dance that points toward the existence of a divine choreographer. Michael Strauss had much more to say about that, and I was leaning forward in anticipation. Chapter 10, Our Miraculous Universe and Planet. Continuing the interview with Dr. Michael G. Strauss. The late Christopher Hitchens, author of God Is Not Great and one of the most ardent atheists of recent times, was often asked which argument for God's existence is the strongest. It's a question commonly posed to many skeptics, and Hitchens had a ready response. I think every one of us picks the fine-tuning one as the most intriguing, he replied. For University of Oklahoma physics professor Michael G. Strauss, the incredible precision of the universe and our planet is not just intriguing, but it's compelling evidence for a miracle-working designer. Over the last 5 decades, physicists have discovered that the numbers which govern the operation of the universe are calibrated with mind-boggling precision so intelligent life can exist, he said as we continued our conversation in his home. And when I say mind-boggling, I'm not exaggerating, he added with a smile. Picture a control board with 100 different dials and knobs, each representing a different parameter of physics. If you turn any of them just slightly to the left or right, poof, intelligent life becomes impossible anywhere in the universe. Even just mistakenly bumping into one of those dials could make the world sterile and barren, or even non-existent, he said. And that's not only the opinion of Christian scientists. Virtually every scientist agrees that the universe is finely tuned. The question is, how did it get that way? I think the most plausible explanation is that the universe was designed by a creator. Can you give me a few examples of the fine-tuning? I asked. Sure, answered Strauss. One parameter is the amount of matter in the universe. As the universe expands, all matter is attracted to other matter by gravity. If there were too much matter, the universe would collapse on itself before stars and planets could form. If there were too little matter, stars and planets could never coalesce. How finely tuned is the amount of matter? It turns out that shortly after the Big Bang, the amount of matter in the universe was precisely tuned to one part in a trillion, 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 he replied. That's a 10 with 60 zeros after it. In other words, throw in a dime's worth of extra matter and the universe wouldn't exist. A calculation puts the number in perspective. The visible universe is 27.6 billion light-years in diameter. Each light-year is about 6 trillion miles. A single millimeter, compared to the diameter of the universe, would still be incomprehensibly larger than this one finely tuned parameter. Strauss continued, British physicist Paul Davies, who's an agnostic, said such stunning accuracy is surely one of the greatest mysteries of cosmology. How does he try to explain it away? He says cosmic inflation might force the universe to have exactly the right amount of matter. Does that make sense? Even if you assume cosmic inflation is a mechanism that works, it doesn't make the fine-tuning problem go away. Why not? Well, here's an illustration. If I tried to pour gasoline into my lawnmower through a really small hole, it would be very difficult. Why? Because the hole is finely tuned. But if I take the same fuel and pour it into a funnel, then I can easily fill the gas tank. Now, does the fact that I have a funnel, a mechanism that works, mean that I've eliminated the fine-tuning problem? No, of course not. If I have a mechanism that works, it also points to a designer. So I summarized, even if cosmic inflation is true, it merely moves the design issue back one stage. Right, Strauss said. Then Strauss offered another fine-tuning example from something he studies in his research, the strength of the strong nuclear force. This is what holds together the nucleus of atoms, he explained. Ultimately, it's the strength of this force that produces the periodic table of elements. I pictured in my mind the colorful periodic table I studied in chemistry class, which displays all naturally occurring elements from atomic numbers 1, hydrogen, to 94, plutonium, as well as several heavier elements that have only been synthesized in laboratories or nuclear reactors. What happens if you manipulate the strong nuclear force? I asked. If you were to make it just 2% stronger while all the other constants stayed the same, you'd add a lot more elements to the periodic table, but they would be radioactive and life-destroying. Plus, you'd have very little hydrogen in the universe, and no hydrogen, no water, no life. But what if you turn the knob the other way? Decrease the force by a mere 5%, and all you'd have would be hydrogen. Again, a dead universe. Another area of my research involves quarks, which make up neutrons and protons. If we change the light quark mass just 2 or 3%, there would be no carbon in the universe. And no carbon means what? I asked. Strauss gestured at the two of us. That you and I wouldn't be sitting here. The examples could go on and on. In fact, entire books have been written about them. Here's another illustration. The ratio of the electromagnetic force to the gravitational force is fine-tuned to one part in 10,000 trillion, trillion, trillion. Astrophysicist Hugh Ross said to understand that number, imagine covering a billion North American continents with dimes up to the moon, 238,000 miles high. Choose one dime at random. Paint it red, and put it somewhere in the piles. Blindfold a friend and have him pick out one dime from the billion continents. What are the odds he'd choose the red dime? 1 in 10,000 trillion, trillion, trillion. But the most extreme example I've seen comes from Oxford mathematical physicist Roger Penrose, who partnered with Stephen Hawking to write The Nature of Space and Time. His calculations show that in order to start a universe so it would have the required state of low entropy, the setting would need to be accurate to a precision of one part in 10 to the power 10 to the 125th power. This mind-blowing number, Penrose said, would be impossible to write out in the usual decimal way, because even if you were able to put a zero on every particle in the universe, there would not even be enough particles to do the job. These extraordinary cosmic coincidences have not escaped secular scientists. There is, for me, powerful evidence that there is something going on behind it all, said Paul Davies, a professor of physics at Arizona State University. It seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming. British cosmologist Edward R. Harrison doesn't hesitate to draw conclusions from the universe's razor-sharp calibration. Here is the cosmological proof of the existence of God, he said flatly. The fine-tuning of the universe provides prima facie evidence of deistic design. And Strauss wasn't done yet. Not only is our universe precisely calibrated to a breathtaking degree, but our planet is also remarkably and fortuitously situated so life would be possible. In what way, I asked? To have a planet like ours where life exists, first, you need to be in the right kind of galaxy. There are three types of galaxies: elliptical, spiral, and irregular. You need to be in a spiral galaxy, like we are, because it's the only kind that produces the right heavy elements and has the right radiation levels. But you can't just live anywhere in the galaxy, he continued. If you're too close to the center, there's too much radiation, and there's also a black hole, which you want to avoid. If you're too far from the center, you won't have the right heavy elements. You'd lack the oxygen and carbon you'd need. You have to live in the so-called Goldilocks zone, or the galactic habitable zone, where life could exist. Are you referring to intelligent life? I asked. Anything more complex than bacteria, he said. Then he continued, to have life, you need a star like our sun. Our sun is a class G star that has supported stable planet orbits in the right location for a long time. The star must be in its middle age, so its luminosity is stabilized. It has to be a bachelor star. Many stars in the universe are binary, which means two stars orbiting each other, which is bad for stable planetary orbits. Plus, the star should be a third-generation star, like our sun. What does that mean? The first generation of stars were made of hydrogen and helium from the Big Bang. They only lasted a relatively short time. The second generation created heavy elements like carbon, oxygen, silicon, iron, and other things we need. The third generation is made up of stars that have enough material to create rocky planets like Earth and carbon-based life forms. Strauss paused, but I could tell he wasn't done yet. There are so many parameters that have to be just right for our planet to support life, he said. The distance from the sun, the rotation rate, the amount of water, the tilt, the right size so gravity lets gases like methane escape but allows oxygen to stay. You need a moon like ours. It's very rare to have just one large moon in order to stabilize Earth's tilt. As counterintuitive as it sounds, you even need to have tectonic activity, which experts said could be the central requirement for life on a planet. Plate tectonics drives biodiversity, helps avoid a water world without continents, and helps generate the magnetic field. Also, it's nice to have a huge planet like Jupiter nearby to act like a vacuum cleaner by attracting potentially devastating comets and meteors away from you. Periodically, newspapers tout the discovery of what astronomers call an Earth-like planet, I said. Yes, but generally all they mean is that it has a similar size as Earth, or that it might be positioned to allow surface water. But there's so much more to Earth than those two factors. How many conditions have to be met to create an Earth-like planet? I asked. Hugh Ross sets the number at 322, he replied. So if you run the probability calculations, you find that there's a 10 to the negative 304 chance you're going to find another planet that's truly like Earth. Still, there are lots of potential candidates out there, I pointed out. One estimate is there could be more than a billion trillion planets. Granted, he said, so let's factor that number into our probability equation. That still means the odds of having any higher life-supporting planet would be 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, In science, he said, we have a phrase for probabilities like that. Really? What is it? There came a grin. Ain't gonna happen. Some scientists, recognizing the obvious design of the universe, have manufactured bizarre explanations for how this uncanny precision could have occurred in a purely naturalistic way. For instance, John Barrow and Frank Tipler, in their book The Anthropic Cosmological Principle, said the universe is clearly designed, which requires intelligence, and intelligence is only possessed by humans. So, they hypothesized that humans will continue to evolve until someday they become like gods, at which point they will reach back in time and create the universe themselves. These are two bright scientists, and it's the best they can come up with? Strauss said, shaking his head. Needless to say, it hasn't gained any traction. Neither has the idea that our universe is actually a matrix-like simulation, being run on a massive computer by some super programmer. After all, that still raises the problem of how his universe came into existence. Then there's the idea, mentioned by Michael Shermer in my interview, that black holes lead to the creation of baby universes, which then create more universes through black holes and so on for eternity. But that leaves open the question of where the first black hole-producing universe came from. Scoffed one scholar, the physics underlying the idea is speculative, to say the least. Another hypothesis that quickly evaporated is that the fine-tuning is a result of random happenstance. The odds of that, scientists say, are functionally equivalent to impossible. The precision is so utterly fantastic, so mathematically breathtaking, that it's just plain silly to think it could have been an accident, William Lane Craig said. As physicist Robin Collins told me, if I bet you $1,000 that I could flip a coin and get heads 50 times in a row, and then I proceeded to do that, you wouldn't accept that. You'd know that the odds against that are so improbable, about one chance in a million billion, that it's extraordinarily unlikely to happen. The fact that I was able to do it against such mathematical odds would be strong evidence to you that the game had been rigged. And the same is true for the fine-tuning of the universe. Before you'd conclude that random chance was responsible, you'd conclude there is strong evidence that the universe was rigged. That is, designed. So what are the most likely explanations for the fine-tuning? Science philosopher Tim Maudlin, author of The Metaphysics Within Physics, published by Oxford University Press in 2007, said there are just two plausible alternatives to the universe's apparent design. It seems that the only reactions are either to embrace a multiverse or a designer. Let's talk about the multiverse option, I said to Strauss. Stephen Hawking talks about M-theory, which would allow for a near-infinite number of other universes. If the dials of physics were twirled at random in all of those, then sooner or later, one universe is going to hit the jackpot and get the right conditions for life. First of all, said Strauss, we don't know if M-theory is correct. It's based on string theory, which is an esoteric concept for which all the equations haven't even been worked out yet. The theory may be untestable and non-falsifiable, and there's no observable evidence for it, so is it really science? Strauss noted that when Hawking proposed M-theory, science writer John Horgan wrote in Scientific American, M-theory, theorists now realize, comes in an almost infinite number of versions. Of course, a theory that predicts everything really doesn't predict anything. Strauss continued, physicists have come up with various ideas for how multiverses could be birthed. But again, there's no observable or experimental evidence for it. In fact, there is likely no way for us to discover something that's beyond our universe. And even if there were multiple universes, the Bohr-Guth-Vilenkin theorem says they must all go back to one beginning point. So now we return to the question of who or what created the universe in the first place. His conclusion? If you want to believe in one of the multiverse theories, you basically need blind faith. Similar comments came from John Polkinghorne, former professor of mathematical physics at Cambridge. The many universes account is sometimes presented as if it were purely scientific, but in fact, a sufficient portfolio of different universes could only be generated by speculative processes that go well beyond what sober science can honestly endorse. Oxford's philosopher Richard Swinburne was blunt. To postulate a trillion other universes rather than one God in order to explain the orderliness of our universe seems the height of irrationality. Oxford-educated physicist John Leslie, author of the influential book Universes, believes that if ours is the only universe, and again, there's no scientific evidence that any others exist, then the fine-tuning is genuine evidence that God is real. I agree, said Strauss. Let's go back to what I know for a fact as a scientist. I know there's one universe that appears to have a beginning, which is incredibly calibrated in a way that defies naturalistic explanations, and there's a highly improbable planet whose unlikely conditions allow us to exist. To me, all of that begs for a divine explanation. I raised my hand. Hold on, I said. Maybe our universe isn't so finely tuned. For instance, why would a creator waste so much space if he wanted to create a habitat for humankind? The universe is unimaginably huge, but it's largely a wasteland that's inhospitable to life. Actually, the universe is the smallest it could possibly be and still have life, Strauss replied. That statement took me aback. I'd like to hear you explain that one, I said. If you start with the Big Bang, and your goal is to make a solar system like ours, you have to go through two previous generations of stars. The first generation left behind some of the elements of the periodic table, but lacked the right amounts of carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen to make rocky planets and complex life. Then the second generation of stars formed from the debris of the first generation. When those burned out, they made more heavy elements and scattered them throughout the universe. Our sun coalesced from that debris. Now, here's my point. This third generation of stars is the first possibility for a solar system like ours to exist. So, if you start with the Big Bang, it takes 9 billion years to create a solar system like ours, which is approximately when our solar system was formed, 4.5 billion years ago. So, if you're God, and your purpose is to create Earth suitable for people, and you use these processes, it would take about 13.5 billion years. And during that time, what is the universe doing? Expanding. Right, it's getting bigger and bigger. So even though it's incredibly large, this is the youngest and therefore the smallest that the universe can be if you want to create one planet that's hospitable for life. Okay, now I get it, I replied. But here's a question that skeptics frequently ask. If God made the universe, then who made him? Nobody, came the quick reply. The Kalam argument doesn't say whatever exists has a cause. It says whatever begins to exist has a cause. By definition, God never began to exist. He has always existed. He is a necessary, self-existent, eternal being. That's part of the definition of God. Why assume a triangle has three sides? Because that's part of what it means to be a triangle. The real question is, does the evidence point toward the existence of such a divine being? I believe it does, and not just the evidence of cosmology and physics. I recalled the words of William Lane Craig in interviews I conducted with him. This is not a special pleading in the case of God, he said. Atheists themselves used to be very comfortable in maintaining that the universe is eternal and uncaused. The problem is they can no longer hold that position because of modern evidence that the universe started with the Big Bang. So they can't legitimately object when I make the same claim about God. He is eternal, and he is uncaused. I asked Strauss, if God is the most likely explanation for our universe and planet, then what can we logically deduce about him from the scientific evidence? Several things. First, he said, grabbing a finger as he went through each point, he must be transcendent because he exists apart from his creation. Second, he must be immaterial or spirit since he existed before the physical world. Third, he must be timeless or eternal since he existed before physical time was created. Fourth, he must be powerful given the immense energy of the Big Bang. Fifth, he must be smart, given the fact that the Big Bang was not some chaotic event, but was masterfully fine-tuned. Sixth, he must be personal, because a decision had to be made to create. Seventh, he must be creative. I mean, just look at the wonders of the universe. And eighth, he must be caring, because he so purposefully crafted a habitat for us. But, as Shermer asked, why not a committee of gods? Why just one? The scientific and philosophical principle called Occam's razor says that we shouldn't multiply causes beyond what's necessary to account for all of the phenomena, he said. Still, how do we know this creator is the God of Christianity? I asked. All the qualities we've elicited from the evidence are consistent with the God of the Bible, he replied. If there's just one creator, that rules out polytheism. Since he's outside of creation, this rules out pantheism. The universe is not cyclical, which violates the tenets of Eastern religions. And the Big Bang contradicts ancient religious assumptions that the universe is static. Hugh Ross, who earned his doctorate at the University of Toronto, has pointed to several ways in which the ancient writings in the Bible reflect the findings of contemporary cosmology. It's worth noting, Ross said, that Scripture speaks about the transcendent beginning of physical reality, including time itself. Genesis 1:1, John 1:3, Colossians 1, verses 15 through 17, Hebrews 11, verse 3. About continued cosmic expansion or stretching out. Job 9, verse 8, Psalm 104, verse 2, Isaiah 40, verse 22, 45 and 12, Jeremiah 10, verse 12. About unchanging physical laws, Jeremiah 33, verse 25, one of which is the pervasive law of decay, Ecclesiastes 1, verses 3 through 11, Romans 8, verses 20 through 22. These descriptions fly in the face of ancient, enduring, and prevailing assumptions about an eternal, static universe until the 20th century. The rumble of a passing truck interrupted my conversation with Strauss. He stood and asked, "Do you want some water?" He went into the kitchen, filled two glasses, and returned to offer me one. I looked at my watch. Because of an appointment that Strauss needed to keep, we were running short on time. But the purpose of my visit had been fulfilled. Thinking over the case Strauss had built, the existence of a miracle-working creator who matches the description of the God of the Bible had been established beyond a reasonable doubt. Strauss sat back down and glanced briefly out the window, turning philosophical in our last moments together. "You know," he said, taking a sip of water, "I'm friends with an artist who says he can look at a piece of art and see the soul of the artist. I can't do that, but I'm a scientist. I can look deeply into the universe and the subatomic world and see the soul of the artist. For instance, I see evidence of his transcendence. So what does that tell me? It tells me that for him, intervening in the world he made is simple. Miracles are trivial. They're easy to do. Then I look at the bizarre world of quantum mechanics. Lee, it's so different from anything you or I can imagine. Virtual particles pop in and out of existence. Apparently, one particle can be in two places at the same time. To me, it's a reflection of Isaiah 55, which says that God's ways are different from our ways. His thoughts are greater than our thoughts. The artist looks at a painting and says, these brushstrokes tell me about the mood of the painter. As a physicist, I know that virtual particles inside of protons have a mass that's finely tuned so I can exist. That tells me something about the mood of the creator. He's both ingenious and caring. Why else would he cause all of creation to accrue to our benefit? Frankly, I look at a painting and say, huh, that's nice. To me, it's just color on canvas. I can't see the deeper realities that an artist can. But I'm privileged to be a scientist. I can see the nuances and subtleties and intricacies of nature in a way that others can't. And invariably, they point me toward one conclusion. The God hypothesis has no competitors. Chapter 11, The Miracle of the Resurrection. An interview with Detective J. Warner Wallace. Even for a decorated cold case homicide investigator, this was a formidable challenge. J. Warner Wallace had used his considerable detective skills to solve murders that were decades old, but he had never tackled a case that stretched back for two millennia. What's more, this time he wasn't merely attempting to identify the perpetrator of a long-ago crime. Instead, he was trying to determine whether the victim was truly deceased, and whether he defied all naturalistic explanations by rising from the dead 3 days later. Quite an assignment for someone who was at the time a hyper-skeptical atheist. Wallace is the son of a cop and the father of a cop. His dad fought crime in Torrance, California, a residential and high-tech enclave south of Los Angeles. Initially, Wallace resisted the temptation to follow in his father's footsteps. He started out with a career in the arts, earning a degree in design and a master's degree in architecture. But before long, the lure of the badge proved too strong. After doing training through the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, Wallace joined the force in Torrance, working on the SWAT team and the gang detail and investigating robbery and homicide cases. Later, he became a founding member of the department's cold case homicide unit, assigned to crack murders that nobody else had been able to solve. His success brought accolades and opportunities. Soon he was being featured on NBC's Dateline and news outlets seeking expertise on what it takes to arrest killers who thought they had gotten away with murder. Through the years, Wallace's street-honed skepticism served him well. As a cop, if you believe everything people tell you, then you'd never arrest anyone, he said. For him, facts need to be solid. Witnesses have to be credible. Evidence must be persuasive. Corroboration is always crucial, and alibis have to be dismantled. In short, he was the kind of skeptic even Michael Shermer could admire. Wallace's skepticism as an adolescent cemented him into atheism. His parents divorced when he was young. His father, at his mother's insistence, would drop him off at the Catholic Church on Sundays, where he would attend a Latin Mass by himself. I didn't understand a word, but it didn't matter, he said. I didn't believe any of it. Plus, I didn't have any Christian role models who could explain why they accepted this stuff. It wasn't until Wallace was 35 that he subjected the Gospels to months of painstaking analysis through various investigative techniques, including what detectives call forensic statement analysis. This skill involves critically analyzing a person's account of events, including word choice and structure, to determine whether he is being truthful or deceptive. Eventually, Wallace became convinced that Christianity is true beyond a reasonable doubt. In a sense, he said, it was my skepticism that led to faith, because it pushed me to question everything, to doubt my own doubts, and to demand answers that could stand up to scrutiny. The answers ended up convincing him that Jesus, in time and space, actually did conquer his tomb, and thereby provide convincing evidence of his divinity. It was this meticulous investigation of the miraculous resurrection that prompted me to jump on a plane and fly to Southern California, where I met with Wallace at his ranch-style house in Orange County. I'm an all-in kind of guy, Wallace said to me. C.S. Lewis said, if Christianity isn't true, it's of no importance. But if it is true, nothing is more important. And I agree. That's why I've jumped in with both feet After becoming a Christian in 1996, Wallace earned a master's degree in theological studies from Golden Gate Baptist Theological Seminary, served as a youth pastor, and planted a church. Currently, he is an adjunct professor of apologetics at Biola University, is a senior fellow at the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, and teaches at Summit Ministries in Colorado. I have been a friend of Wallace's for several years, ever since I wrote the foreword to his book, Cold Case Christianity, in which he offers 10 principles from his detective work that can be used to examine the reliability of the Gospels. His other books include God's Crime Scene, in which he examines 8 pieces of evidence from the universe that make the case for the existence of God, Alive, which focuses on the resurrection, and Forensic Faith, which helps readers become better defenders of Christianity. Ever the artist, Wallace creates his own drawings to illustrate his books. During his 2 decades of investigative work, Wallace was awarded the Police and Fire Medal of Valor Sustained Superiority Award and the Cops West Award for solving a 1979 murder. Although now retired from the force, he still consults on cold case homicides and acts as an investigative consultant for television networks. Wallace and I even did cameo appearances in the motion picture God's Not Dead 2, where we testified on the historicity of Jesus in a fictional court case. Today, this once-doubting atheist travels the country to speak on becoming a Christian casemaker, or someone who can effectively articulate the evidence that backs up the essential claims of the faith. Wallace is a bundle of crackling energy, speaking in fast, clipped sentences, sometimes verbally machine-gunning others with a flurry of facts. He's constantly taking his eyeglasses off and putting them back on as he speaks, almost using them as a prop. Slender and fit, he looks as though he's still in good enough shape to run down a burglar, although at the same time, his close-cropped silver hair gives him the air of a senior investigator. I've always appreciated Wallace's no-nonsense, just-give-me-the-facts exterior, which syncs up well with my own journalistic bent. But I also admire what's underneath, an exceedingly compassionate and gracious heart toward others. I know because I've been the grateful recipient of his kindness in the past. Oddly, though, I'd never talked at length with Wallace about his journey from atheism to faith. After we sat in his recreation room and chatted for a while about family, I asked, "What prompted you to start checking out the Gospels?" My wife, Susie, was raised with a cultural Catholicism, so she thought it was important to take the kids to church, and I went along, he explained. One Sunday, the pastor said, "Jesus was the smartest guy who ever lived, and our Western culture is grounded in his moral teaching." How did you react? I thought, I'm a cop enforcing the penal code, but I know there's a universal moral law above that. After all, adultery is legal, but it isn't right. So it got me thinking about where that moral code came from. That's why I went out and bought this. He pulled a red pew Bible from the shelf and handed it to me. "I got this for $6, he said. I flipped it open to a random page and saw it was very neatly but quite thoroughly marked up. There were homemade tabs, notes in small print in the narrow margins, and color-coded underlining throughout. I went to the Gospel of Mark and saw that it was thoroughly annotated. I was using forensic statement analysis to analyze the Gospels. For instance, here in the Gospel of Mark, I was looking for the influence of Peter, so that's what one of the colors represents," he explained. "I was nitpicking the details. By the time I was done, I'd gone through 3 Bibles." "How long did your analysis take?" "6 months. "What was your verdict?" "That the Gospels reliably recorded true events," he said. "But that presented a problem for me." "Why?" "Because they talk about the resurrection and other miracles," he said. "I could believe the Gospels if they said Jesus ate bread, but what if they said the loaf levitated? And come on, I couldn't believe that. I didn't believe miracles could happen, so I rejected them out of hand. I could relate to the impediment of the supernatural, since it was a stubborn obstruction in my own spiritual investigation. What changed your mind? I inquired. I asked myself, do I believe anything supernatural? And I concluded, well, yes, even as an atheist, I did believe something extra-natural occurred. For instance, the Big Bang, he replied. Everything came from nothing. If nature is defined as everything we see in our environment, then there had to be something before that, a first cause that was beyond space, matter, and time. That meant the cause couldn't be spatial, material, or temporal. I smiled, remembering my conversation with physicist Michael Strauss in the preceding two chapters. I realized, Wallace continued, that if there was something extra-natural that caused the beginning of all space, time, and matter, as recorded in Genesis 1:1, then that same cause could accomplish all miracles recorded in the Gospels. In other words, if there is a God, then miracles are reasonable, maybe even expected. So you got past your presupposition against the miraculous, I said. I did. As a detective, I knew presuppositions can derail an investigation. I remember a case in which a woman was found dead in her bed. She was a locally notorious drug addict, and there was drug paraphernalia on her nightstand. The patrol officers got there and didn't even bother to pull down the sheets, since this was so obviously an overdose. But when investigators got there, they pulled down the sheets, and they saw she had been stabbed to death. He paused as the implications registered with me. Presuppositions can be impediments to truth, he said. The resurrection was the most reasonable inference from the evidence, but I was ruling out miracles from the outset. What led you to conclude that this first cause of the universe was personal and not just some force? I recognize that there are universal moral laws, he replied. For example, it's wrong to torture a baby for fun in any culture, anywhere, anytime. And transcendent moral laws are more than simply truths. They are obligations between persons. If there are objective, transcendent moral obligations, the best explanation for them is an objective, transcendent moral person. Okay, you concluded that the Gospels contain reliable eyewitness accounts, even of the miraculous, I said. What came next? I was stuck on the why question. Why did Jesus come, die, and return from the dead? I started analyzing Paul's writings. And I was amazed by his insights into what he called natural man or sinful people. His description fit me in an uncanny way, he replied. Plus, the message of grace is so counterintuitive. Every other religion is based on performance, which makes sense because humans love to achieve and compete to get a reward. This message of grace, of unearned forgiveness, didn't sound like it had human origins. It came off as either ridiculous or divine. This doesn't prove anything in and of itself, but it was one more piece of the puzzle. In the end, then, it was a cumulative case, I said, a declaration more than a question. Bingo, he said crisply. The totality of the evidence overwhelmed me. When we're trying to solve a homicide, we typically put all the facts on a whiteboard and see if we can make the case. I didn't have to do that here. The case made itself. As someone who covered criminal justice as a journalist for years, I'm fascinated by how DNA evidence has been used to solve crimes that happened decades earlier. For Wallace, though, DNA hasn't been a factor in any cold case he has solved. Typically, we've solved them through the analysis of eyewitness testimony, he said. And that's the way I tested the Gospels. Michael Shermer believes they're just moral stories that don't have a historical core to them, I said. Why are you convinced they're based on eyewitness accounts? There's good evidence that John and Matthew wrote their Gospels based on their eyewitness testimony as disciples of Jesus. While Luke wasn't a witness himself, he said he carefully investigated everything from the beginning, presumably by interviewing eyewitnesses. According to Papias, who was bishop of Hierapolis, Mark was the scribe of the apostle Peter, and my forensic analysis of Mark's gospel bears that out. In what ways? Mark treats Peter with the utmost respect and includes details that can best be attributed to Peter, Wallace replied. Mark also makes a disproportionate number of references to Peter. And unlike the other Gospels, Mark's first and last mention of a disciple is Peter, which is an ancient bookending technique where a piece of history is attributed to a particular eyewitness. Of course, he continued, Peter called himself an eyewitness, and John said he was reporting what we have seen with our eyes. In fact, when they were arrested for testifying about the resurrection, they said, we cannot help speaking about what we have seen and heard. Over and over, the apostles identified themselves as witnesses of everything that Jesus did in the country of the Jews and in Jerusalem. Nevertheless, I interjected, you and I both know that eyewitness testimony has been challenged in recent years. In fact, some defendants convicted by eyewitness testimony have been exonerated through new DNA evidence. No question. All eyewitness accounts have to be tested for reliability. In California, judges give jurors more than a dozen factors to weigh in evaluating an eyewitness account, he said. We can apply these tests to the Gospels. For instance, is there any corroboration? Did witnesses have a motive to lie? Did their stories change over time? When we do, we find they hold up well. How early do you date the Gospels? Acts doesn't report several major events that occurred in the AD 60s, including the martyrdoms of Paul, Peter, and James, apparently because it was written before they occurred. We know Luke's Gospel came before Acts, and we know Mark was written before Luke because he uses it as one of his sources. Even before that, Paul confirms the resurrection in material that goes back to within a few years of Jesus' execution. When you consider that Jesus died in AD 30 or 33, the gap shrinks to where it's not a problem. So, it doesn't bother you that the Gospels were passed along verbally before being written down? I asked. Not at all. I've seen witnesses in cold cases say their memories from 35 years ago are like it happened yesterday. Why? Because not all memories are created the same. What do you mean by that? If you ask me what I did on Valentine's Day 5 years ago, I probably couldn't recall very much. That's because it's only one of many Valentine's Days I've celebrated with Susie. But if you ask me about Valentine's Day of 1988, I can give you a detailed report of what took place. I cocked my head. I give up.